I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Petzold today, and I'd like to begin by having you talk about what led to your decision to pursue a career in music education.
Well, that's fairly easy. Didn't have to eliminate too many choices. Having graduated from high school at about the height of the Depression, you couldn't afford to go away to school. And having been active in high school music groups, the logical choice was Milwaukee State Teachers College, which had a very good music program at the time. And the high school band director took a group of us high school seniors up to the campus, where we were greeted and royally treated by some of the faculty up there, and we kind of liked it. It was an easy commuting run, about 3/4 of an hour from where I was living. And so I just kind of gravitated into music up there simply because I'd been active in high school. It would not have been my first choice of a profession, but that was the handiest thing. I had already applied to the Colorado School of Mines because I was interested in engineering, mining engineering, but the tuition even in those days was exorbitant, and the problem of getting out there was another problem. So I just decided to stay there, and I'm kind of glad I did. It was an enjoyable 4 years, frustrating at times, but very interesting. The program was pretty well set. The entire institution, as you can well imagine, was being called a teacher's college, was geared in the direction of getting people prepared to go out and teach. And so being in the field of instrumental music, that was my choice of a major, with a sort of a secondary minor in choral music at the time. But the entire institution did not clutter up the program with a lot of extraneous courses. They had a set of core courses in the general physical and sciences and the social studies. And the music program did not have a great deal of depth in music theory and music history, but that was not the purpose. The purpose was to just give you a background, you see. And most of the time we were learning different instruments and polishing our skills. They did not have any applied music instruction at that time. And so in order to continue my own study of the violin, which is my major instrument, I had to study privately with a teacher in Milwaukee. But we did have instrumental techniques classes, basic things, use the old Rubank method, which I guess is still hanging around some places or other. But so we'd have a semester of horn, a semester of flute, a semester of trumpet, and I passed out of the strings except for string bass. I took a semester of string bass, but cello I learned on my own. And then we had clarinet, which I started as a freshman, and liked it so much that that became my second instrument, because one of the aspects of the program was if you were in the orchestra, you also had to be in the band. The first semester, I had some private instruction in percussion from a fellow who had been a national drumming champion or something like that. And I still remember sitting down in the basement apartment in the Cudahy Towers in Lakeshore, Milwaukee, taking snare drum lessons from him. But by the end of the first semester, I got into the band playing timpani and snare drum, and then that was enough for me. I felt that I better do something better than more interesting. So I had the clarinet that I'd started in the instrumental techniques class, or clarinet class as it was, and then supplemented that with private clarinet instruction from one of the upperclassmen in school. And in fact, that's the way we learned a lot of our different instruments. And I taught some of my classmates violin and viola, and they in turn taught me bassoon and flute, things of that kind. And we always did this on our own time, never had school time for that.
You didn't get credit for that?
Oh, not for that. No, 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 no. It was a good experience, so you learned an awful lot. And we always knew where we were heading, because in our senior year, before we could go out to practice teach, which was a full semester, full time at that time, you had to have a performance examination. The band director, Hugo Anhalt, was of the old school, military German type. He was an interesting person, that's one way to put it. Kind of a martinet. He conducted both the band and the orchestra. And so when you're all set to go do your student teaching, he'd call you into his office. Out on the table in his office would be an array of instruments. And he'd have the Rubank books, and you'd always go to the back page where you have these review etudes and things like that. He said, well, Petzold, pick up the bassoon and play me number so-and-so. Then you'd go to another one. You'd go in there shaking.
I bet.
And you'd come out not much better. But at least you did a lot of practicing, and you got ready for it, so that when you got out, you were always one step ahead of the beginning students. And then you learn from there, you know. But we had one semester of conducting. That was it. We had a full year and a half of theory, and then a combination semester course of counterpoint and formant analysis, all put together in the same thing. And then it was two separate courses, but only a semester long. And we were writing 2 and 3 part fugues in the counterpoint thing. Not very inspired, but at least it was experience, you know. And we had a course in arranging that helped out. But most of the time, you just kept doing your thing, you know, and you had time to practice once in a while. They didn't have very many practice rooms, but since I was commuting, I'd stay up for the evening rehearsals of the choir. And so we had the band rehearsed at 8 o'clock in the morning, 3 days a week, and the orchestra rehearsed at 8 o'clock in the morning, 2 days of the week. And so we were kept fairly busy, and then choir would meet until maybe 9:30 at night on one night a week. But throughout the years that I was there, I think I learned quite a bit during the senior year. I did a lot of arranging for the choir because they were well into this 8-part choral stuff at the time, the influence of Noble Kane and other people, and so I was doing some arranging for them. The choir went on tour for about a week during the course of the year, and so I was the violin soloist to keep the audience amused while the choir went off and rested. The band always went on tour for a week during the interim between two semesters. And so it was really a very interesting experience all the way through. Most of us were lucky enough to get jobs. Some of them were better than others, but practically all of the band and orchestra directors around the state had been graduating from Milwaukee State, and so they would keep you posted whether there was an opening and encourage you to apply. But it was a nice, closely knit group up there. And for a good many years, we always had get-togethers and teachers' convention time.
Now, at that time, would UW-Madison have had any music education people in the job market?
I would guess so. I didn't know much about it. We didn't hear a whole lot about Madison, except that they did have a theory program and a history program, and I know they had a music education program. But there were not too many students involved in it, and the rumor had it anyway that principals and superintendents around the state would prefer to hire people from Milwaukee rather than from Madison because they felt they had more background in the actual on-the-job training for teaching. So I didn't know a whole lot about Madison at the time. I had a cousin that came here after I had graduated, but his interests were not in teaching music. His interests were in performance, so that if you wanted performance, you could come to Madison. But if you wanted performance in Milwaukee, you went out and sought it on your own. Then you had some interesting additional experiences. The man who taught theory and arranging had organized a Milwaukee Youth Symphony, and a great many of the college students were playing in that. So that was a good experience, and we do about 2 or 3 concerts a year. Try not to conflict with college concert dates, but that was interesting. See, in those days, Milwaukee did not have its own symphony. It depended on the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to come up and give a series of 10 concerts in the year. They did have a sort of a civic orchestra called the Milwaukee Symphony, but it was kind of a ragtag group that got together and put on maybe 2 concerts a year, and that was it. So the only symphony experience available to those of us that were interested were the college symphony and the youth orchestra symphony, which did not have any high school students in it at all, not that time.
Well, now eventually you came here to UW-Madison to do some graduate work. And that was after World War II, I believe?
No, I started, I had taught for 2 years. I graduated from Milwaukee State in 1938, and I put in 2 years of teaching in Cuba City, which I understand is not too far from your hometown, and decided that I wanted to get a master's degree. It seemed to be the thing to do. And so I came to Madison for that first year after, for 1939-1940, and began work on a master's degree. Well, I found that they found in evaluating my Milwaukee work that I was shy in some things. I didn't have nearly enough counterpoint in a couple of music history courses, and so I had a few deficiencies to make up. So I spent that first year and the preceding and following summer on my master's degree, which was in musicology, interesting enough, mostly because they didn't have any graduate music education classes. At that time, if you wanted a graduate degree in music education, you went over to the School of Education, the Department of Education, and you worked on a master's degree in teacher education or something like that, with an emphasis in music, but it wasn't a music education-oriented program at the time. I think you really didn't have much choice. It was either music history, music theory, or performance. That was it. And so, having spent that year, I then took a teaching job in Racine and was there for a year, and then got married in 1942 and was called in into service the day after Christmas. So for the next 4 years, I was completely out of the profession, spending delightful time basking on the sunny sands and the palm trees of the South Pacific. But after the war, I came back and resumed my master's degree, which I finished, and got a job teaching at Wisconsin High School, which was at that time the campus laboratory school for the School of Education. the methods people had been teaching there, and they were beginning to get more and more graduate students and undergraduates as a consequence of the GI Bill, and so they wanted somebody to go out to Wisconsin High, and that's where I stayed for the next 3 years. And having finished the master's degree, then I just logically kind of fell in and did some work on a PhD in the field of teacher education. And again, there were not very many graduate music education courses available. As I recall, there were about two.
Mm.
And that was it. Everything else was in the field of general education. And so it was interesting. You have a question here, who was my most memorable teacher? I can't think of any offhand that were that memorable. There were some very fine teachers. I remember the person who taught music history, Leland Kuhn, had been in World War I, and he would sit ramrod straight in his chair. He had some very good seminars in music history, one in modern French, one in the Wagner. You really got to know things there. And he was ultimately a very fair person. Not very friendly, but very fair. And I think the first contact I had with anybody in music education was after Pop Gordon, whose name I'm sure you've heard of, mm-hmm. retired. They had a couple of folks in here. And then after the war, when I began working on my doctorate, Bjørnar Bergathon came to the campus here, and we worked very closely together. He was a pretty good guy, and after he left, why, Sam Burns took over and eventually became chairman of the School of Music. But the most memorable people that I had contact with were over in the School of Education.
Who were some of...
Oh, Arvel Bahr was the man in teacher education at the time. He spent most of his professional life trying to identify the characteristics of good and poor teachers. He told me one time when we went out to lunch after I passed the prelims, he said, you know, here I've spent 35 years doing this, and I still don't know any more about a good and poor teacher than I did when I started. I said, well, you hang around, maybe you will one of these days. But there were some fine people there. We had some interesting faculty here in the School of Music. I don't think that very many of them were particularly influential in my own course of action, except Bergathon. Because I liked his style, and I liked the way he gave people credit for being able to think and do things independently.
Mm-hmm. Was there funding for graduate students in those days? Were there TAs?
I never heard of any. In the School of Education there were, but very few assistantships were available. And since I was already teaching at Wisconsin High on a full-time basis, except for the 1 year of continuous residence, I really didn't need any funding support. I had the GI Bill, which was eminently generous as far as we were concerned in those days. And looking back, I think in the School of Music, there had always been a band assistant to help out with a marching band. There may have been one or two others who had sort of teaching assistant roles for the large lecture classes, the string quartet course that the late Gunnar Johansson always taught, and maybe a course in symphony that somebody else taught. And so they needed help with that. But I don't remember there being huge numbers of assistantships available, except for maybe three or four a semester. I don't believe they had any student assistants in the applied music field at all.
And then you became a professor here eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
And was it 35 years that you
35, did? 35 years. Thoroughly enjoyed every one of them. Never decided I wanted to leave, although I did teach at other places. periodically and so on, but not for any extended period of time. And I think over the years, Julie, it's the school, just as a consequence of the way in which the world is moving, it had increased enrollments. My wife graduated from here in 1940. Well, we got married, and then she came back and graduated after, while I was still overseas. And at the time, there was a very small graduating class. All of the men were in the service, you see. So I think there are probably no more than 15 people in the in the School of Music graduating senior class when she did. A lot of the students who played in the band and the orchestra were non-music majors, of course. And but the gradual increase in student enrollments did not really occur until about 1945, 1946. Then the whole campus began to bloom.
So did the atmosphere really change? You had been there in 39, you said.
Yeah.
Just the general mood and...
Well, when you consider when I first came to Madison from Milwaukee State, which was a very small school, there were only 8,000 students on the whole campus here, and all over the campus. There weren't nearly as many buildings, and you had no problem finding your way around or anything like that. And, registration would proceed very rapidly. But then they began to have all of these enrollment increases. I remember the first graduate class I took over in the School of Education was toward my doctorate. And my goodness, we had probably 25 or 30 people in that, all doctoral candidates, you know. And over time, why the number of graduate students obviously increased, and most of them were returning veterans, who always were older than the typical undergraduate and graduate population here. And as a consequence of all of that natural growth, why the School of Music faculty increased in size. And although I probably am jumping ahead a little bit, I think the one person who probably had more to do with getting a broader range of faculty was the former and late chairman of the school, Dale Gilbert. He started off here teaching voice, and see, we have a very democratic process on the campus here. You elect a chairman, unlike other institutions who can bring somebody in from the outside. We vote on, or nominate and vote, and that's how you get selected. And so there was money available. He had the support of the dean of the College of Letters and Science, because that's our home, and we're able to fund new positions and bring people in to teach the wide range of applied music. Before the war, as I recall, there were two full-time, one part-time piano teachers. There was one full-time voice teacher, male, and I think there was a woman who also taught voice. There were the chairman of the School of Music, who was the director at that time, Carl Bricken, directed the orchestra and taught counterpoint, basic theory, and then another person who was here up until maybe 8 years ago, Lockhart, taught the other theory classes and the arranging and so on. And we had two or three people teach music history, basic courses, and so on. Started the artist in residence notion with the Pro Arte Quartet, and they taught quite a bit of the string pedagogy, string applied violin, applied viola, applied cello, and so on. And They were fun to study with. They would coach quartets, you know. But it was a very small faculty. Housed over in the, where Music Hall is, you got them all up in one floor and down in the basement. Ray Dvorak had his band office downstairs, and Dick Church, or the whoever preceded him as orchestra conductor, was down there. The facilities were pretty sad. The record library was right in with the rest of the library. So if you wanted to listen, you sat down at one of the library tables and put your headphones on, and that was it. You didn't have too much choice.
Now, as they added all of these faculty members, how did that affect your teaching duties? Did you have to do a lot of different things at first?
Well, when I first came on board here, my responsibilities were, to put it bluntly, doing what everybody else didn't want to do.
Oh.
I taught clarinet, basic clarinet. I did a semester of string techniques. We had started, and I was in on the beginning of that, an elementary education program, teacher education. And so we developed a series of courses called Integrated Arts. And everybody took that. It was a very interesting concept. And so there were four of us involved in handling that, one in theater, one in dance, one in art, and me in music. And so we taught this integrated arts for elementary ed majors. The way it operated was we started the program with only 50 students, no more. They were selected very carefully. The grade point averages were much higher than they are now because of the selection process. And so the classes would be divided into four equal groups. And during the course of the year, they would rotate from music to art to dance to drama. And then the sophomore year, they would do the same thing again. So they got the equivalent of a whole semester in each one of those areas. And the staff would meet regularly. We would plan joint ventures. And it was quite an exciting time, you know. And so I did that. Then for years, the Ag School had what they call the Ag Short Course. And so they wanted somebody to handle the music there, so I would go out and have a pickup band and conduct that for those who had instruments. Lead community singing in the assembly once a week or maybe twice a week, which was not really part of the teaching responsibility. I would assist at the methods class. By that time, I would do the instrumental methods, and the other person would do the general music vocal methods. And supervise student teachers.
You were busy.
And as I look back at it, it really was far more than I cared to do, or really should have been doing. So finally, and because my appointment at that time was half in the Department of Education and half in the School of Music, nobody was looking out for my best interests at all, until finally I decided that what I needed to do was make a shift, that if I was going to do mostly education, then I wanted to be mostly in the Department of Education rather than the School of Music. So that finally occurred, and I probably could dig out the dates, but it was, I would guess, about 1955, 1956, when finally I was put over predominantly in the Department of Education. And of course, by that time, the music faculty was already beginning to show its diversity, and you had the musicologists, music history people in the one camp, and the applied performance people in another camp, and the theorists in a third camp, And as is true at many institutions, the music education faculty was the fourth camp. And of course, you always had the performance organizations. And from a staff of one music education person, we gradually moved to two. I was the second one, then three, and finally increased it to commensurate the number of students we needed to serve.
How have the students changed over time? If you could compare, say, when you were a graduate student to perhaps in the 80s even. That's sort of broad, but...
Well, I think there's been a kind of an interesting shift. I think students now generally are... Well, I shouldn't say now. I should say that when I was working with graduate students, particularly master's degree people, they were more interested in having things spoon-fed to them. They were not interested in seeking things out on their own. And the doctoral students, on the other hand, quite a bit different. And I think that's why I enjoyed working with the doctoral candidates so much, because you could get their interest aroused and they take off on their own. It was most refreshing. Undergraduate students, over the years that I was associated with the School of Music, they came in much better prepared, much more musical in their performance medium. And more interested in doing a variety of things. The quality of the organizations over the years improved dramatically, I think. The symphonic band was much better. The orchestra began to do some fairly significant works. But the master's degree program, which I think I mentioned the last time we spoke, was a rather curious animal. The School of Music had, and may still have, a charter by university rules and regulations, the ability to offer a DMA and a Master of Music degree. But we have no Master of Music Education degree, as you know. And anybody who is out teaching music in public schools, coming back to Madison for a master's degree, could either major in education and take certain courses in music. About half of them could be music, graduate music courses of history, conducting, arranging, orchestration, so on. And they'd come out with a master's degree in education, an MS in education, dash music. That was how it was identified. Took a good long while before Madison abandoned the cooperative efforts with the state teachers' colleges, which then became state universities, and then offered their own master's degree programs. But we had a lot of the cooperative master's degree students who would come to Madison. They'd do half of their work on the home campus, and then the other half, they'd have to be here to get the graduate courses that they needed, because the teachers' colleges were not permitted to offer certain kinds of graduate courses. So the whole institution changed dramatically. I mean, what it is now, the University of Wisconsin. I remember sitting in for many months when Milwaukee State Teachers College became University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, try to iron out course numbers, course offerings, and so on, and a very uncomfortable period of time, as you can imagine. Because I still had a very fond place in my heart for the good old Milwaukee State Teachers College. And in fact, some of the people I graduated with who came back here after a while to do graduate study, many of them ended up in some of my own graduate classes, would say, don't call me a UWM student, call me an MSDC student.
Could you say, think of some memorable societal changes that impacted the student body as a whole in your years that you were here?
Well, the 60s. Need I say more? my own role changed over time. In 1965, I became chairman of the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. And that was unheard of for anybody in music or music education to go into that lion's den, you know. And I found that very interesting. And it's like a lot of things people do. You want to find out if you can do it, and if you can, why, okay, you've proven yourself. And during the interim, during the second year, the dean of the School of Education left to go to Northwestern. Now, he was a very interesting person, Lindley J. Stiles. And he was gung-ho on research, of course, and felt that that was the wave of the future. And so he left for Northwestern. They brought several people in, and they brought in Don McCarty, who had been at Cornell. And he wanted an associate dean, and so my name was suggested, so I had 3 years as an associate dean of the School of Education. Well, it was during that time that we had all of this unrest on campus. And so here I am doing all of that stuff and trying to teach at least one graduate course a semester. And that was about all my load would permit. And after 3 years, I decided that that really wasn't what my major interest was, especially since I kept getting not many, but occasional calls, would you be interested in being a candidate for a dean of the School of Music at Florida State, for example, or some other place? Or would you be interested in having your name put in for a dean of the School of Education? Well, now that kind of split bothered me, because I, by that time, I'd had enough experience to know that I really wouldn't feel comfortable serving as a dean of a school of music, because by the middle 60s, most schools of music had already had their own mode of operation. And as you probably know, at a certain point, people in applied music weren't talking to people in other areas and vice versa. And I didn't feel that interested in pursuing the dean of school of education kind of thing, because it's hard to provide much leadership when you're fighting budget and politics and so on. So I just decided that I'd go back and do what I felt comfortable doing, and got out of that. But that period from, I would say, from 1967 to 1970 was a very traumatic one for the campus.
It sounds like it, from what I hear.
Oh. Well, we had demonstration after demonstration, tear gas on the hill. Students would rampage through the classroom buildings, running in to classes, distracting the professors and so on. They would even stand in locked arms and not permit students to go into the building, because they were encouraging strikes against whatever.
Would you say the School of Music students would have been in on all that just as much as anyone, or would you know?
Oh, heavens, no. School of Music students are well-mannered, well-behaved. There were always a few, but for the most part, they did not get much involved at that time. Mm-hmm. Later on, they became more active, but during the height of the 60s and the height of unrest on the campus, I think the School of Music was kind of an oasis of calm amidst the storms everywhere else.
That's interesting. So I wonder if they did any special musical things. Like you hear of some colleges that they might have a special concert that the students would put together, or you wouldn't recall anything like that that they would have done.
No, I don't remember anything like that.
They were just sort of living in their musical world. And
well, you see, we had the SAI, sorority, and the Phi Mu Alpha Symphonium, and they put on concerts once a year. And most of the time, the School of Music students were busy doing the kinds of things music students always do. And I don't think they paid that much attention, although I may well be doing them a great disservice. But I didn't remember very many of the undergraduate students going out and picketing or anything like that. Later on, yes, but not during that particular period. And of course, graduate students were far too busy doing what graduate students do in music and for that matter in education to involve themselves in the politics of the time. With perhaps one notable exception, the Department of Educational Policy was perhaps the most liberal of all. And there were students who were doctoral students who were on strike and all of the rest of that. Some very curious things happened during that time. But once the Vietnam War stopped, the order came back to the campus, and I think students began to settle down and be a little bit more serious about the business of going to school. But I think in the interim, they began to become much more concerned about the vocational aspects and the job prospects than of the mind-expanding opportunities available to graduate students.
That's interesting, too. Now, everyone seems to mention the 60s when you talk about things like that. Are there any other things that would stand out in your mind, big School of Music events or anything like that through the years?
I wouldn't want to trust my memory. I have trouble remembering what happened last month, let alone what happened 8, 10, 15 years ago. Yeah, there were several things that took place. University celebrated a centennial in 1948, and of course they had big doings for that out at the field, you know.
In the music department
music,
or something?
They had bands, and of course the orchestra played, the choruses sang, and so they had a big centennial celebration out at the football field, which was a good place for it.
Sure.
And, over time, there have been some very interesting concert series that the School of Music sponsored. I remember when I was a master's degree student, why they had a whole series of nothing but the Beethoven quartets, and then another series of nothing but the Beethoven violin sonatas. Most of the time, the Pro Arte Quartet were the performers, one way or another. We had a lot of guest conductors coming in, and of course, the thing that really was interesting was the way in which this School of Music began the summer music clinics and hired somebody to come in and do that out of extension, rather than have the director of the School of Music serve as the head of the music clinics. But I think, if my memory serves me correctly, Madison was the first to have summer music clinics. And they were really very well done. 2 weeks in duration, with outstanding national figures coming in and conducting the orchestra, the band, the choir. People like Dean Dixon did the orchestra. They had Aaron Copland one time, as I recall. Choir directors, John Finley Williamson, Peter Tkach, and Chris Johnson, Paul Chris Johnson, You know, you go around the country and you find the top lead men, and they would come here and they would work with these high school students. But it was only high school students, not junior high. And as I say, it was very intensive. And they would give a concert at the end of the first week and a concert at the end of the second week.
Now, when again, maybe you said, do you know when that started, the summer music
club? No, I couldn't pin it down exactly. It started in the middle to late 30s. And then continued right on. I think it probably got started, I wouldn't want to make a guess, but I know it was going as early as 1934, 1933.
So it has been a while.
Oh yeah.
We talked a little bit earlier about how maybe in the early years applied music was the focus, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
And over time, have you seen that change, or would you say that Madison is still regarded as that being the focus?
Well, let me say that quite likely it's no longer the primary emphasis that it may have been at one time. I don't know how my colleagues out in the field at the other institutions in the system view their role, but certainly when they became the University of Wisconsin Dash something or other, why they went to installing complete programs, duplicating in many ways the same kinds of things that were going on at Madison, but instead of having the luxury of one flute teacher, one oboe teacher, one bassoon teacher, they would have one woodwind teacher, kind of thing. Well, you know what your experience at Platteville was. You had a lot of double duty people going on there. And so I think that for people that really wanted to study applied music and do so seriously, quite often the high school students would come to Madison because they would have access to a very fine violin teacher, a very fine horn teacher, and so on, not one who was trying to do everything. Although the string person, at Platteville, also taught in the public schools there, was a very fine teacher. And so I guess some of the students did go there. But over the years, I think traditionally most universities did emphasize more and more the field of music history, musicology, putting performance kind of second, you see, as more appropriate for a university. And if you ever read anything on the history of the college, university, and so on, you begin to see particularly the way in which music departments and schools of music function. Because lots of times the old departmental lines still clung tenaciously to the institution, and you had some very curious kinds of, I won't say warfare, but a lot of anxieties going on that I had a chance to observe firsthand at the University of Texas, where I taught for a summer, and the person who was dean of the School of Fine Arts down there was himself an organist. And so he wanted very fine performance groups and very fine applied music. And he really couldn't care much about music education except that it was a necessary evil, because that's where most of the students came and helped pay the bills.
Would you have seen lines like that in Madison?
Oh, yeah. Well, faculty got along fine. It's not that you have confrontations, but there are certainly different points of view about curriculum that you get from applied music people as opposed to music history people, as opposed to music education people. And I have to say, over the years, my experience with people in music education is that they are much more broad-minded, much more flexible than people in the other disciplines within the typical music school, music department. They have to be, because after all, a music teacher depends on the skills that are acquired from the theory people, from the applied music people, from the music history people, and so on. And it's refreshing to even find that every once in a while, the people in these other disciplines will ask music education faculty what they think they ought to be teaching. Not just to the majors, because there aren't that many majors at the undergraduate level, as you know. I don't know what the percentage here is, but at one time, it was pretty much 85% were music education students here.
Really?
Yeah.
I wondered about that.
And certainly at the former teachers' colleges, and it still may be true, because that's the major role it plays, 95% are music education students.
Now, when did that change here at Madison? Because you had said at one time, more than likely, they would have hired people from Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I wonder when that trend switched over so that there were so many music ed people here.
Well, I think it was a gradual process. I think the music education program began to come of age after the war. And here you have to get involved in the history a little bit. The first music educator on the Madison campus was Pop Gordon. He came here, as I recall, in 1921, and Tony Marisi can tell you all about that, you see. And he was it. That was the only music education person. He taught two methods courses, one elementary, one secondary. All of the student teaching was done at a single school, Catholic school, St. James. That was it. And there weren't that many students. My wife was one of them at the time. And so he handled all of the music education. We depended on the rest of the faculty to teach the instrumental techniques classes, the conducting classes, the theory classes, and so on. And we had established very fine working relationships over the course of the years with saying, well, now, we think these are some of the kinds of things that our prospective music teachers ought to be getting from these kinds of courses. And they usually listened because, after all, most of the students were music education. Well, after Pop Gordon retired, a man who then went to Michigan State, Bill Sur, S-U-R, it is written, a very fine person, was the music education man. And he taught at Wisconsin High School along with the methods classes here. Pop Gordon never did that, to the best of my knowledge. In fact, I don't think they had anything but maybe a graduate student out there. Sir was followed by somebody named Alfred Ahrens, who was himself working on a doctoral degree here. And after Ahrens left, my memory, I don't want to trust it that much, but I think then Bergerthon came. And he was here for about 4 years. I think he left about 1950, somewhere in through there. And as I say, Bergerthon was a very attractive, personable kind of a guy, a little acerbic at times, but he attracted a lot of graduate students. When he left to go to Illinois, Sam Burns came on board. And Sam had been supervisor of music in Ohio and in Louisiana. And he was of the old school. And eventually, after a couple of years, he became chairman of the School of Music. And so he started the ball rolling on getting a broader faculty representation than we had had. That was carried on by Dale Gilbert, and still going on today, you see. But during the course of that sequence of events, there was some very interesting relationships were established. Pop Gordon established the School of the Air music program, Journeys in Music Land. He had organized a madrigal group, and they made up of undergraduate music ed majors mostly, but some were in there who were not. And they did all of the singing over in WHA studio for the program. They'd have their big festival, students coming from all over the state to the Stock Pavilion every year. And he carried that on. The music clinic was growing and growing, eventually led to the development of Music Extension with people who had outreach responsibilities for clinics and things of this kind. So that over time, I think the role of the School of Music has become much less insular, much less isolated than it was up until about 1940, 1942.
And what was that relationship between the Extension and the School of Music? I've wondered about that. For instance, I saw a bulletin of the Extension, and they offered music methods by correspondence until at least 1931. That's the bulletin that I saw.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that's before my time. I don't know really what they were doing. I'm not sure. I don't know why they would be offering methods courses. I could understand music appreciation classes being offered by Extension on a correspondence basis, and several of the faculty were doing that in theory as well. Extension at the time, I think, was literally viewed as that. That is, they would make available Extension activities for people who wanted to improve or maybe even earn credit. And the faculty in this School of Music would develop course outlines, might even supervise the instruction itself, but it was mostly correspondence kind of stuff, you see. Very seldom did the well, there just was nobody in Extension. I think Emmett Sering was the first full-time Music Extension person. And then he carved out a role for himself, developing the All-State Band Orchestra, of course, and taking over the music clinics. And Dick Wolf came into the picture about that time, doing those kinds of things. Ed Hugdahl went out and did his church music things, you know, his organ things. So Extension had its own music division with relatively little relationship to the School of Music as such. That is, they had their own standards for employment, their own expectations for what the job called for. Very few of the faculty over in Extension had joint positions with the School of Music. I think the first, well, I think Emmett Sering did by virtue of the fact that he was brought here to conduct the band when Ray Dvorak was in that terrible accident. And then he went full time. He literally carved out a position for himself. And in fact, Music Extension here became sort of a model for music extensions around the country. And the music faculty, some of them, may believe that there was no such thing as Extension. They wanted nothing to do with it. They would just assume that it go its own way and not be identified with the School of Music in any way at all. Others of us felt that it was a fairly important venture and that we ought to give it support. But it took a long time before faculty had joint appointments in both Extension and the School of Music. Right. And even then, I think without being anything but candid, Extension faculty were viewed second-class citizens, not just by the School of Music, but by other departments on campus as well. You see, Extension as a movement started in the College of Agriculture anyway. And it was only later that other departments and schools on the Madison campus became involved in it. But having been involved in more committees than I care to think about over the 35 years, invariably at some point or another in the course of a discussion, you'd come up with, how can we make the academic offerings of Extension more respectable? Well,
there you have it.
the key was joint appointments. Mm-hmm. If you are willing to do the kinds of things that Extension users want, then it's fine. And I remember going out and doing some things in Extension. I taught some kind of short courses for elementary music teachers, the kinds of things that you would do, how to play an auto harp, how to play a recorder, all that kind of stuff, you know. I had great fun doing it. One night a week for 4 weeks, you go down and drive down to Duclair's or Monroe or somewhere else. Within the School of Education, I think the Department of Educational Administration was the leader in these off-campus ventures, because if you examine the role of the kinds of administrators we have in the state, most of the high school principals and superintendents had their doctoral degrees from Madison, and practically all of them had their campus offerings transferred to the community in which they were teaching or working. So Extension, over the period of time that I was involved with it, underwent quite a substantial change and began to have joint appointments. But even in the Department of Education, if you were an Extension education, you were not viewed as quite as seriously as if you were in the department itself. It's in some ways analogous to the people who feel that there's something superior to being a high school teacher as compared with a junior high or even an elementary school teacher, you see.
Right.
That kind of pecking order sort of thing. But I don't know how it's changed now. You'd have to ask those that are active with it.
Well, one thing I have to ask you, Jerry Olson said, was about your own research. He said it's first of its kind. Could you tell me a little bit about that and what made it unique?
Well, I can give you some background as to why I got involved. Getting tenure here requires that you do research. And up until 1959, my own teaching responsibilities, supervising student teachers, at one time I would have 25 to supervise, for heaven's sakes. You know, you can't do a good job of that. Well, my teaching responsibilities were just too much. And the dean of the School of Education and the chairman of the Department of Education said, "Well, if you want to get tenure, you better get yourself involved in research." Well, I've just been champing at the bit to get involved in some kind of research. And some very good friends of mine over in the Department of Education were working in what they call the handwriting laboratory, doing all kinds of interesting things there. They had grants of money from Parker Penn and a little bit of seed money from the U.S. Office of Education. And so they were dealing with perception, visual perception, as part of the handwriting scheme. And so they invited me to try to come up with some notion that I might want to explore. And so I decided, well, perception, auditory perception, what the heck, that's made to order, you know. So I did a pilot study, didn't get any funding for it at all, but just went out, developed some kind of a test. It was a very simple, straightforward sort of thing. Kids would hear something, then they'd sing it back, and I'd tape it, and then check the accuracy of it, and so on. You can imagine the many inches of tape you listen to get that done. Now you can computerize the whole thing, but that was not it. Well, I was interested in that, and the people who were working in the handwriting lab there also seemed to think that there was some potential there. So I submitted a proposal to the U.S. Office of Education Cooperative Research Branch, and it was the first one that had been submitted in the field of music. And the woman who came to the campus to talk to me about it said, well, I don't know anything about music. She was a test and measurements person. But it's so unique to have anybody in the field of music submit something that has something to do with education, that we'll give you some funding for a semester. And so I did that thing on auditory perception. And finally got through, collected all of the data, processed it myself, and got the article written and put it in the Journal of Research, the Journal of Experimental Education. And then I decided that that was a good start, but let's do some other stuff. So I submitted another proposal. Well, once you get your foot in the door, they are reluctant to shut it on you. And so I had a second one, and it just kind of developed into a longitudinal study. And it was great fun. It was great fun.
And how many years were you doing this project?
Oh, let's see. I think the longitudinal one covered 6 years.
Mm.
And I had different projects during the course of that, but I did follow kids from first grade through sixth grade to find out what changes there were. And while it didn't have any noticeable impact on music education practices, it did give rise to some interesting dissertations in other campuses and so on. So, and there's a book, I should say a pamphlet, put out by a couple of women from the Office of Education that summarized the music education research efforts of the cooperative research branch of the Office of Education. And it kind of spells out, lists a lot of these projects. But it was the first one, and so I guess when you get your feet wet, I tell you, I remember 1960. That was after the first report was published. I was invited to do a paper at the MENC convention in Atlantic City. I didn't have any notion that there would be many people interested, and it was scheduled for 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and I was correct. There were about 8 or 9 people there. But at least I went there, and then kept doing other things, got involved in research activities of the MENC and so on. And so I've seen music education research in this country change dramatically. It improved and increased dramatically over the years, not due to anything I was doing, but just because it was a natural consequence of what was going on in the field.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you are entirely welcome.